Here we go on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Wheeler here. And we are turning our attention, as we approach noon, to weather with Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute of Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison. He's a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. And John Martin will be with us soon. John, I expect, he's teaching, isn't he?
Yep, he's teaching an intro class, I think, Introduction to Weather and Climate, a very interesting and popular course.
Very popular. Yeah. How many students in there normally in that class? 100 at least.
I think we kind of combined two of them. So okay. I think there's about 200 and then about 100 of them or so also have a lab that goes with it. So they meet an extra hour a week. Learning how to interpret weather maps.
Yeah, very, very cool. Well, John will be with us, but in the meantime, we've got Steve here to talk weather and climate and kind of get spring outlook, talk a little bit about that with you. You may have a weather question or a climate question. I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. Or go ahead and post on our Facebook page at The Larry Wheeler Show. We'd love to hear from you. And I guess spring's almost, I mean, some parts of the state are still.
Yeah, we had some interesting weather last week, right? We had some snow down here and even a lot more just to the north of us. So, yeah, it's that time of the year where you can get some really good storms going that dump a lot of precipitation. For us, we had rain, we had sleet, we had freezing rain, all in the area down in the south down here.
And I'm seeing just as driving from Madison to Milwaukee, you go across a couple of bridges or a few bridges, and I'm looking down at the rivers, and that seem a little high. I mean, they're
things are water levels are coming up. I think a lot of the water in Wisconsin was up higher than normal right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It seems that way to me anyway, as I look. Jim and Holman has something for you. Hi, Jim.
A lot of water.
Jim, are you there?
Yes.
Hi. What's on your mind?
I was just asking, you guys know a lot about the world weather. Where do you think would be the perfect place to live with the perfect weather, anywhere in the world? Not too hot, not too cold, no tornadoes, no hurricanes.
Boy, if I had to pick a place, this is a great question. I'm sure John will pick someplace different
because
he'll want snow. We'll have to ask him that.
Yeah.
But I think I would go with something like Hawaii. Where it's as you're saying, it doesn't get too hot, it doesn't get too cold. You get some nice precipitation, but it's not severe precipitation. You can get hit by a hurricane every now and then, but it's not that common. So I think that's where I would go.
Yeah.
And then you're near the water, too, which is also great.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
where would you go?
What's that?
Where would you go?
Well, I was thinking the same thing, Hawaii or somewhere in the Caribbean, perhaps, although they do get a lot of hurricanes.
Yeah, that's the difference with the Caribbean. I think you run a higher risk of getting hit by a hurricane.
That was a good answer. Thank you. I'll make my plans now.
That's right. Make your retirement plans. Yeah.
Oh, man. I've visited Hawaii on our Wisconsin Public Radio tour just two years ago now? Oh,
yeah,
my
I think
gosh,
it was two years ago
already, but that was my first time. And I just, I loved it.
Yeah, a couple of years ago, we had some meetings down there in preparing for an experiment. And it's nice. And the thing is that it's not like Southern California, like San Diego, where the weather gets pretty boring because it's consistently one temperature. And you don't get that rain like you do get in Hawaii. You always get that afternoon rain and therefore rainbows and things like that.
Well, I can't still like it here, though.
I wouldn't move. I'm hoping Ann, my wife, isn't listening to this because she's like probably making airline plans.
Oh, man. Well, what can we, speaking of weather, what are we going to expect out of our spring weather here.
You know, we're losing our strong signal, which is a seasonal signal, because seasonal forecasts are tough to do.
Yeah.
El Nino is actually returning, to the more natural state, so we're not having a strong El Nino. And that was good for forecasting our wintertime above average temperature, which is pretty much what we had.
Yep.
So looking at springtime, it's sort of the back to the flip of the coin. Probably going to be warmer than normal, but precipitation-wise, really tough to tell.
You know, this morning I had the chance to visit with Louise Bjorklund, who was the spouse of Bob Bjorklund, who was a great writer for the Wisconsin State Journal for many years. And I remember him covering the tornado, the very bad, bad tornado of Barneveld,
right, yeah.
Many years ago. And because this time of the year, I always start thinking about Barneveld and the tornado and tornadoes in general.
Yeah, we're switching to thunderstorm season and severe weather season. And in fact, since we come on at the end of the month, we don't often get to talk about the severe weather awareness week, which occurs usually in the middle of April. This year it's April 11th, April 14th. So there's a lot of activities going around the state with regard to prepared.
So it's a week to draw attention to being ready?
Yeah, being ready. How do you deal with tornadoes? How do you deal with flooding and things like that? The National Weather Service, again, going across the state, will be doing lessons on becoming a tornado spotter. You can take a course with them. It's a couple-hour course, and they go over how to identify a tornado and then report that. So if the National Weather Service, if you want to report a tornado and you're a tornado spotter, then, it counts because they know that you've been trained to identify tornadoes and not funnel clouds and things like that.
Todd in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Todd. Thanks for calling.
Thanks. Hi. I get my weather from the NOAA website. And down below, there's a thing called forecast discussion. And they always talk about the weather at so many millibars. And I know millibars translates to altitude up. And how does that work? What's the relationship between millibars and altitude?
Yes, that's a really good question. It's called the hydrostatic equation. So there is a direct relationship between the pressure and the altitude at which that pressure is at. And it's a function of a couple of things, gravities, which is pretty much fixed, and the other is temperature. So if you take a layer in the atmosphere from the ground up to, say, 800 millibars or so, and then you heat that layer, that's going to cause the air to expand and raise the height of that 800 millibar surface.
And a millibar is how much?
So a millibar, on average, it changes as you get higher, but on average, it's about 10 meters. So 30 feet. You go up about 30 feet, and you're going to drop about a millibar.
So roughly you can just figure 30 feet for every millibar. So 800 millibars would be 2,400 feet.
Yes. As you get higher, it gets more expansive, so it goes up. But that's my rule of thumb that I use. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, sure. Makes sense. Thanks, Todd. And Pete in La Crosse, hello to you. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. When I was on last month, we talked about major cities having higher CO2 levels than observatory at Mauna Kea. And the gentleman explained, it would be of no scientific value to measure the CO2 levels in our major cities. But, Larry, my question is for you, and that is, do you think it would be of political value to have a CO2 sensor on display like at Milwaukee or Madison and ask our politicians, if it's not climate change and CO2 issues, what's going on here? Because I think that rubbing people's noses in it could get them to quit promoting sunspots and other things as being the cause of our changing climate. What do you think?
All right. What do you think, Steve?
I think it's a good idea to monitor it, particularly if we are going to go into global treaties that deal with carbon emissions. And so doing it in cities would be a good idea because, as you're pointing out, that's where a lot of it does go. With regard to getting politicians to change their mind, you know, I think that there are some politicians we will never change their mind. And for whatever reason, I mean, if you already can't change someone's mind because, you know, 99% of the scientists understand that global warming is occurring and that's causing global change and it's due to human activities. You know, they're in the political realm and they're saying that to make certain people happy. And I think the only way you're going to get to change their mind is to change the mind of the people who they're trying to make happy.
Hmm. So in other words, if
evidence doesn't count with some of these people, providing the evidence that this is happening.
Frankly, I think national polls show that the majority of people feel that there is climate change and that it is man-made.
Yeah, which is the amazing thing, you know. And you hear politicians; they still say it. You know, I'm no scientist, but so listen to the American Meteorological Society, where they poll their members, and 96% of them, you know that or are confident that global warming is occurring and human activities are playing a role. So it's mind-boggling, and I guess it explains why my only C in my academic career was in political science. I just don't get it. But it is a serious problem, as you're pointing out, Pete, is that, you know, presenting the evidence sometimes just doesn't get in into people's minds. So it's a whole good topic area for science communication and how to do that communication, yeah. which is tough.
Got some people in my department who are working on that.
We got some great people on this campus in your department, School of Journalism, who deal with that issue because it's a tough one.
Yeah, it absolutely is. Pete, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate the call very much. We have, well, let's go to Carl in Madison. Carl, hi, thanks for calling.
Yes, hello. I always enjoy this conversation. The February smashed all records, and not just by a small amount, but by a substantial amount. And when people talk about 1.35 degrees Celsius over the globe, people think, well, you know, that doesn't sound like a very big number. Up in the Arctic, it was 20-plus degrees warmer than the typical historical record. And the last 10 months in a row have all been the hottest for that month in recorded history. So the challenge here is you talk about scientists who know these facts and can get as far as Larry Mueller's program to talk about them, and then the tremendous gap to the political realm where many climate scientists talk about, you know what, that's just not my territory. I'm not an advocate. I'm supposed to be objective in it.
You know what? Carl, stay with us. We need to take a quick break, and we'll be back. Stay with us. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we take a look at weather and climate with our weather guys. I'm Larry Mueller, by the way. Our guest, Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, and John Martin, professor, former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW. Steve is also, of course, a member of that department as well, and always fun to have them come by. They always come by the last Monday of the month, and we talk weather and climate. Questions for them, call us at 800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And we had Carl from Madison on earlier, Steve, who had talked about the records. We talked about February being the hottest.
Yeah, February for most of Wisconsin, the average temperature was 10 degrees above normal for most of the state. In some places, even higher than that, 12 degrees.
Yeah. Just unbelievable.
Incredible, which means our winter for this year is going to be really above normal once again.
Yeah, yeah, I think we ended up at, 3-5 degrees above normal for the winter or something?
Right, yeah.
We just had a column in that a couple of weeks ago, yeah.
And he mentioned the Arctic was 20 degrees warmer than normal.
Yeah, yep. It's one of those situations, again, where things are warming up.
Yeah. And, you know, that's a critical time of year for the Arctic because that's usually the maximum extent of the sea ice up there. And so if you're warm in February, it's bad news for regrowing that ice next year. So it's really, you know, it can compound itself. One warm year can lead to another.
And he's wondering what we can expect in the future. And I've been reading a few things. Some people were saying that the rise in sea level could be much faster and much greater than originally thought.
Yeah, there's some people saying that. I'm not sure myself. I'm not an expert in that, so I can't really say that I know, you know, with certainty. But there's some up and downs. But the overall long-term trend for the hemisphere, for certain locations in the hemisphere, is not favorable for returning to something that's more stable in terms of cold in the middle of the winter. It's getting warmer in the wintertime. And this particular winter for the whole hemisphere, on average, was the seventh warmest in the last 67 years by one measure, a sort of a weird arcane measure, but it's one that's pretty easy to talk about. And the last 2 years in a row were the warmest ever. So we're really in an era where we don't get, you know, middle of the road cold winters anymore. We get unusually warm ones in one degree or another.
Yeah. Aren't you keeping track? You're doing some research kind of in that.
Yeah, I'm looking at the aerial extent of the air that's colder than 23 degrees Fahrenheit a mile above the ground over the whole hemisphere. Sounds like such a simple thing to do. And boy, when you do it, you find out there's a systematic shrinkage of that cold pool over the last almost 70 years. And I say almost because we just don't have a 70-year record yet. We have a 67-year record, and it is systematically shrinking over those 67 years. Wow. It's scary, and that's middle of the winter. So I'm not looking at spring or I'm not looking at summer. I'm looking at the wintertime. How cold does it get in the wintertime? And it does not get as cold as it used to.
Have you looked at the other seasons as well?
Yeah, I have, but not in the kind of detail, actually. No. But the minus 5 air, the 23 Fahrenheit air, disappears at a mile above the ground in mid-July for about 2 weeks. It doesn't
really
exist
typically.
Anyway. Yeah.
Oh, huh.
And the range at which it disappears now is, of course, expanding. The season for no such air is getting longer in the summertime.
Right, okay,
so
which would be consistent with our longer.
That's one way of looking at the summer side of this problem. Yeah.
Wow. So we have a new way of defining summer, perhaps.
Yeah, maybe.
Right,
maybe.
Get away from this astronomical way.
Yeah, right.
Wow. Well, that's fantastic. Again, Carl, well, we lost Carl, but thanks again for your question. Patricia and DePere is up next. Hi, Patricia. Thank you for calling.
Good afternoon. Well, I'm delighted to hear your program. I think it's very interesting. But I'm calling this noon because I'm concerned about the way the issues regarding climate change have been framed. I think we've spent a lot of time focusing on the environment, which is absolutely appropriate. But I do feel that there should be much more emphasis upon public health. And this is certainly born the director of the American Public Health Association has been very clear about saying that climate change is one of the most serious health threats facing our nation. But we are, when we address it, we're talking about groundwater and air and water, and we're not saying about how the changes are affecting the health of the public, which I feel is extremely important. And I think if we changed our focus, we might get more buy-in from our legislators. Maybe I'm being optimistic, but I think that they would recognize that it's not the polar bears, and it's not the penguins, and it's not the glaciers, which are indeed being affected, but it's us, our human beings, that are being affected.
Yeah, I think you have a good point. I think we're beginning to see the needle swing that way and seeing more talk about particularly tropical diseases moving further northward, particularly those carried by insects and mosquitoes, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So we're starting to hear more discussion of that in terms of how moistening an area, warming that area, leading to more precipitation means that there'll be more mosquitoes, more breeding, more insects moving northward. So I think we're starting to see it in some realms.
That's true. And in fact, we have an expert, a world expert on our own campus, probably more than one, but the one I know, Jonathan Patz, who's in the Center for Sustainability in the Global Environment. He's been on this issue for a long time. He's a medical doctor. He's been on this issue of climate change as a health issue for more than a decade, and he's very high profile. He was in Paris, I believe, this fall, and so this is something that's not getting perhaps as much media attention as the work that's actually being done might merit, because there is a substantial effort in exactly the regard that you suggest.
Very interesting. Thank you very much, Patricia. Appreciate your call. And let's turn to Walter and Tomahawk next. Hi, Walter.
Hi. I'm glad to hear you guys. You know, I got my degree in meteorology up there in 1962, so I'm what you call an old original here. But I've got a question that's been bothering the heck out of me. We burn millions upon millions of acres during this drought period out west, and they obviously put a whole bunch of stuff into the atmosphere. What can the models do to account for that stuff, or do we just have to, you know, go on and guess on what's going on. And that's my question.
Hmm. Okay. So, yeah, there's two ways that the models try and handle forest fires or any kind of fires of vegetation. One is the production of smoke and how much that'll produce. That doesn't have so much an effect on climate because it'll get washed out by the atmosphere precipitation systems. And then the other is how much carbon gets put into the atmosphere. And so they do have relationships between the type of vegetation and its state, whether it's healthy or dried out, and how much and how hot the fire is that we often observe from satellites. And they use those relationships to try and predict how much gases are being added into the atmosphere.
Yeah, and I bet you some of the sophisticated models, I think the weather research and forecast model, the chemistry version, probably does look at distribution of particles, and they might have to make a guess based on these parameters. Mm. But that has some impact on nucleation, like Steve was saying about getting rained out. But I think the other thing that's maybe a mystery, at least it is to me, is whether or not human-induced forest fires, some that are done to clear land, really scale in a substantially different way than naturally occurring ones. I think this is probably a small aspect of the climate problem, but I could be wrong about that. But I know that naturally occurring wildfires is actually part of a healthy environment in certain locations of the globe, and even without human interaction. So it may be that it just doesn't scale 100 times worse than what would occur without human beings, the way that taking fossilized carbon out of the ground certainly does.
Yes.
So,
There we go. Thank you, Walter, for calling. Appreciate it very much. You can join in, too, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@WPR.org, or go ahead and post on our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. Greg in Watertown sent an email. He read that El Nino is changing to La Nina. Wonder if that's the case and what it means, if it is the case.
Mm. So usually we switch back and forth, but before we go from El Nino to La Nina, usually we enter into these natural states. If I can, actually El Nino is a natural state. So
but sort of the zero anomaly.
Yeah, kind of the zero anomaly state, which is what we're heading towards right now.
Yeah, that's often the case. That doesn't necessarily mean we go into a cold event. I don't know what the forecast is, but these things always relax back to the average one way or the other. Whether they're followed by their opposite is another question, and it may already be published. I just looked
at it last week, they're going back to the natural. What do we call that? We don't call it the natural
background
state.
Background state.
There we go. Martin in Green Bay called in wondering about the tornadoes experienced in the U.S. during the wintertime. Was that normal? There were some bad ones.
Hmm. We had some bad ones in the Southeast. Now we come back to that situation where is it normal or not normal? Hmm. They have occurred before.
Yeah.
So it's normal in that sense. Whether or not we're going to get more and more of those types of situations as time goes on is...
That's an interesting question. Yeah. The peak in the Southeast U.S., probably from western North Carolina down to Alabama, Mississippi, really begins in late January, early February, and ends about now, late March. And then it moves, further to the north into Oklahoma, the Great Plains state. So, I agree with Steve. Yeah. I think it's very hard to say whether there's something particularly abnormal about this winter's tornadoes. They happen, most winters.
Right,
they do.
And so, we did talk about severe weather week, but somebody else was wondering about Severe Weather Awareness Week is what we talked about earlier. But somebody else, I think, had missed that part and wondering what it's about. It primarily comes during tornado season.
Yeah, so it comes in April, just before we really hit our peak. That's actually a month before, which is good, right?
You want a little
advance. You want advance notice. So, it's April 11th to the 14th. What happens is there's a lot of education activities going on. To educate folks if they don't know how to react to some severe weather. I think the day after that, I think maybe it's April 14th, there's a statewide tornado drill. So everybody does a tornado drill, again, as part of that training activities.
So there's stuff going on everywhere in the
state. Yeah, it's stuff going on everywhere across the state.
Yeah, and on that same day, I'll just throw it in, we're going to have the director of the National Weather Service here on campus for 2 days on the 14th and 15th of April. So I didn't think of that till you just said it.
Yeah.
Louis going to be here when we're doing our statewide tornado drill.
That's right.
So he'll maybe have something to say about
that. And campus is a weather-ready nation campus
that's correct.
As well.
Yes.
We got that designation last
yep.
year.
That's right.
And so, and Louis is going to be talking about...
On Thursday night at 7 o'clock in Ingram Hall B10. We don't know the title of his talk yet. It's probably going to have a technical side to it that has to do with meteorological science, but it's probably also going to have elements of great interest to the public, and we're going to publicize that as soon as we get the title.
And the date is?
Is April 14th.
Okay,
Thursday,
so it'll
April
be before you're on again.
Yeah. Yeah.
Before you're on again. So
that's correct,
probably,
yeah. Right, yeah. That's correct.
Probably good to mention that. Well, give us some more information. We'll try to post it up on our Facebook page
great.
So people
right.
have, you know what's coming and
good.
And so forth.
Great.
And we had... there was another question that I wanted to follow up on. Oh, the question about the class. We were talking about John's class and how kind of a, you know, a lot of interest in that class. And Steve had called in and wondered if community members can audit the class, the 101 class.
Yeah, I have quite a number of them, in fact, doing that right now. So you can do that. I think the stipulation is that the university would prefer that such people do not raise their hand in class and ask questions during class time when the professor could interact with students who are paying. But that's the only restriction I'm aware of. And I'm quite friendly with a couple of the people. They walk back toward the building with me every time in class. So I love having those people in there.
Yeah, and I used to get a lot of, when it would happen, folks who have retired and they're doing that, which is great. And I don't discourage them from asking questions because they usually have some really interesting experiences.
Yeah.
You know, I could talk about, you know, the launching of D-Day and the importance of weather, but they were like, hey, you know, I was there.
Yeah. I get them in sort of the way that I think they ask you to try to do, and I'm talking to these people all the time, and so they bring their questions to me, and then I bring them up in class.
That's
so
right,
it's
yeah.
just as
yeah,
if they
come down afterwards.
Yeah, it works just as well.
Yeah.
So there you go. Pete in Iowa has something for us. Hi, Pete. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks for taking. This is kind of a different kind of a question, but I know they're both concerned about air and water conditions. And if I was opening a restaurant, I'd have to be regulated by how much grease goes out the top of my smokestack, you know, if I had a restaurant. I'm just wondering about what years did the carbon industry become maybe exempt from water and air regulations, and, you know, how long has this been going on? And, you know, I'm assuming that rapidly increased the global warming situation. And maybe the standards are worldwide that way based on the influence that they have. But I just wonder if they are able to address the lack of or when that occurred when they were exempt from air and water regulations.
Well, I'm not sure that they're entirely exempt from air regulations, but
yeah, and I don't know the policy issues around oil exploration and you know, extracting it from the ground and so on, but I'm sure that they probably have manufactured a series of regulations that are a little bit more lax than any of us would like, probably just through political power, but I don't know any of the details.
Yeah, I'm not sure either, though. The EPA was beginning to start talking about regulating
CO2.
Carbon and CO2.
Yeah.
And so I think that's probably usually the situation, right? You're normally exempt until somebody steps in and says, well, wait a minute, this isn't good. We need to start doing the controls. And I know there's a lot of legislation, the legislators pushing back on that, saying that carbon dioxide wasn't a poison, but actually, if you fill a room with carbon dioxide, you're going to die.
Yeah, right.
It's like saying water's not a poison. It's like, well, it's not, but you can drown.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly.
And EPA is only 45 years old or 44 years old, so.
Yeah, but I don't know the status of that legislation in terms of what the EPA is doing to rule.
Be worth another show with some folks.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, thanks, Pete. Marianne and Hartford, your turn. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. When it comes to the area of just a few degrees in higher, and people think, oh, well, that doesn't matter. Someone told me one day, if you have a little child and they have a fever, you don't worry about it if it's 1 or 2 degrees. But as it gets higher, you get very worried. And they said that's the way the Earth is. When it's a few degrees, it just doesn't seem important to us. And when they described it as being like a child, it really struck me that it was important.
Mm. Actually, that's an interesting analogy. And
it is.
I might extend it to a different way where, so if a child has a warm temperature, you know, slightly above normal. Even if it's small, you don't worry about it. But when it's like that for 3 months,
right,
then you should really start trying to figure out what the heck's going on.
Yeah, right. There's laws against you allowing it to go for 3 months.
That's right. You know? That's right. Yeah, right, there ought to be laws allowing us to warm the planet this long.
Right. That's a really good way to think about it.
So, yeah, it's that whole trend again, which is the real thing for us as well, is that it, even though it seems small, the fact that the trend has actually been rapidly increasing is where the worry is.
Yeah, and the fact that it fits like hand to glove to some of the theories that surround, you know, suggestions about why has it been doing this, and those things just turn out to match right up, and you've got the other side effectively now relegated to saying you can't pass laws that will change the weather. That's their argument now.
Oh, is it really?
So, yeah, that's a former presidential candidate said that not long ago, about a month ago or so in a debate. You can't change the weather by passing laws. So, therefore, let's do nothing. What a good argument.
Okay. Well, let's see.
Good point. Good analogy.
Here's another question on a different topic. John in Wausau called in. He wants to know if barometric pressure can affect clocks.
I would not think so. Not
think
a well-designed clock.
Yeah, right. I imagine there's such a clock that probably is, but right? It's not a good one.
I suppose it would depend on, and different styles of clocks.
Yeah, the mechanical ones, I wouldn't think so, with the wheels.
Right,
and even the electric ones, I wouldn't imagine that the pressure would change it much. And certainly the atomic ones aren't going to really care about the pressure is.
And I think wristwatches that you can dive down 100 feet in the water or something, I think the pressure resistance doesn't do anything to the mechanism. I think it has to do with keeping things dry or something.
Right.
You know? So, probably not.
Yeah.
So there you go. We have, thinking ahead here, looking ahead, we've got, what do we got for spring? We got spring. let's have a little of it.
Relatively chilly couple of weeks coming up, I would say. It's not going to spring out before April 6th-ish or something like that, but it's not going to be terrible. But then, you know, when you get to April 6th, as soon as, if you've had a gloomy, relatively cool period, anything that comes next is going to feel glorious. So that's going to be the payoff. That'll be the payoff. So sit tight. The next couple of weeks won't be great.
All right. Well,
the tulips are up, right?
We do have another caller we should probably take, as a matter of fact. Ron in Wanakee looks like he has something for us, and maybe we can get that on, get Ron in here before we close off. Ron, hi, thanks.
Yes, hello.
What can we do for you?
I have a question. You know, you have the CO2 and the methane and all those issues of burning coal and oil that heats the atmosphere. But what I want to know is to what degree the direct release of energy, no matter what form of energy you're using, nuclear or solar or wind, all releases heat. And to what degree is that a material impact on the release of energy? No matter, even if you go all natural, all wind, all solar, still releases mechanical energy that converts to heat.
Yeah, but you've got the second law in your favor, because all mechanical energy converted to heat becomes atomized. It's horribly inefficient. I don't know if I can answer the question directly about the ways in which numerical forecast models of weather systems, for instance, take into account heat output from a city. But I'm pretty sure that they have some mechanism by which to do that, because they're depending upon measurements of temperature at highly spaced locations, and those temperature measurements are actually going to reflect the very release of the energy that you're talking about to a large extent, but maybe not entirely. You know, people who study, who are modeling wind farms, have to pay attention to where they space them and so on, and that probably has something to do with the mechanics of the turbines, maybe not so much the energy that they generate.
In the case of nuclear, there's no release of anything, hopefully, but that still generates heat that you're used to heating your home or what have you, but it's clean, but what impact does it have on climate?
Mm.
You know, my guess would be that local climate, it could have a big impact, but global, probably not much. Although I'm hesitant to say that, because whenever you talk global again, you got to talk about long term. And the accumulated effects of things. But, you know, we always make these analogies to, you know, when we have a snowfall of an inch, you know, how much energy is that?
Yeah.
It's a huge amount.
It's enormous,
of energy, which makes, you know, and when you convert it into electrical energy, for example. Mm-hmm. And so it would make a, you know, a particular facility pretty small in comparison.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
There we go. Yeah. And with that, we are out of time. Mm-hmm. My daughter, my 12-year-old, says, why can't you ever believe an atom? And when you mentioned atomized, I thought of that, and I said, well, I don't know why. And she said, because they make up everything. On that note, Steve Ackerman and John Martin will be back the last Monday of April. You stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.